Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. Hey everyone, welcome back to the show. Happy Friday. As per usual, need to really note that these extra episodes on Fridays that we release are brought to you by your Supercast subscribers who have decided to support the show as we expand our coverage and really up our production and our team, all those great things. So if you want to support The Realignment, you could go to realignment.supercast.com, or you could go directly in the show notes. If just 3% of our overall listenership subscribes, which is the industry standard, we can really, really, really do some really great stuff as you're moving into the 2024 election. So we'd love the support. On to the episode. I'm speaking with Phil Klei. He is the author of Uncertain Ground, Citizenship in an Age of Endless Invisible War. This is a topic which is going to be up a lot of people's alleys. This has been a thing that's been relevant ever since the war in Ukraine started and America drew down in Afghanistan, effectively ending the 20 years of war since September 11th. There's all these questions about citizenship, who gets to call the shots when it comes to foreign policy, what responsibility you have if you're frankly, someone like me who has, you know, decently hawkish views, but hasn't served in the military. These questions are pretty uncomfortable, not just when they come up in the comments section. So Phil is really the right person to speak with us with. He is a veteran of the U.S. Marine Corps, and he is the author of Redeployment, which won the 2014 National Book Award for Fiction. And he recently released Missionaries, which was named one of the top 10 best books of 2020 by the Wall Street Journal. So lots of great stuff here. I know you all will enjoy the episode. Of course, thank you to our other sponsor beyond just Supercast, Lincoln Network, and hope you all enjoy the book and this conversation. Phil Klei, welcome to The Realignment.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm really excited to speak with you just because as a civilian who's deeply interested in military matters, I'm a fellow at a think tank, obviously do work, a lot of work in the foreign policy and defense space. A lot of the questions that are coming up in your book really resonate with me personally. And also I think are going to resonate with members of the audience who come on to different points of these debates. But let's just start with some words you use in the title of the book to get to some definitions. What is your definition of an endless war?
Well, I think what we have right now in America is this sort of ongoing use of lethal force abroad. So I don't know what to call it other than a war that happens mostly out of public sight and isn't much discussed. You know, I was in the Marine Corps from 2005 to 2009, and I was in Iraq as part of the surge, right? So there was this, you know, increase of troops to Iraq as part of this new strategy. And it was fiercely debated, you know, anti-war groups took out a full page ad in the New York Times to critique, you know, what a general was going to testify before Congress about in September of 2007. And there was a lot of debate about this. And I was a public affairs officer. So, you know, part of my job was working with media, and we were trying to like entice them to come in and see what the troops were doing, right? That was sort of part of the job, this sort of sense that we have an American flag on our uniform. What we're doing on behalf of Americans. So it is a political issue of extreme importance and something that people should know about, right? I have friends, you know, the question vets often talk about getting when they come back is, did you kill anyone, right? And I have a couple friends whose answer to that is a sort of standard, if I did, you paid me to do it, right? You know, which is a sort of way of throwing the question back in somebody's face. So that was, you know, that was the Marine Corps in the war that I was a part of. As time went on, though, we shifted to a very different way of doing war, right? And I think the Obama administration was a sort of pivot point because he brought down troop levels in Iraq, then pulled troops out of Iraq, right? While doing a surge in Afghanistan that proved to be a bloody failure, right? To put it mildly. And after that, you had the rise of ISIS. And so you had this Obama administration that had a lot of anti-war backing that was sort of uncomfortable with large troop presence. And yet, the American public clearly wanted something done about ISIS and was, you know, for lots of reasons to want to oppose ISIS, right? And so they started bringing in special operators, right? Increasing airstrikes. Obama famously used drones a lot. And we had this escalating war where we were heavily, heavily involved in the fight against ISIS. And yet at the same time, we're claiming that the war is over, right? I heard Ambassador Susan Rice brag in 2015 when all this was going on that one of the Obama administration's proudest accomplishments was ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, right? And Obama said the same thing at a fundraiser a couple months later. And so you had this shift towards an increase in the use of special operations, an increase in the use of drones and airstrikes and working through proxy forces. So where we were doing a lot of highly lethal things, but we were sort of claiming that it wasn't war, right? And I think the sort of final shift to that phase came with the end of you know, our true presence in Afghanistan. And there was, you know, a speech that Joe Biden gave where he said, you know, the war is over. And then he said, but we'll continue to use over the horizon strikes, right? So we're going to kill people, but there won't be any war, right? Which is a somewhat strange way of discussing things. And so for me, you know, if you're an American citizen, a significant portion of your tax dollars goes to the Department of Defense, right? A major aspect of your country's presence around the world has to do with military force, with our intelligence services. And yet a lot of that stuff happens totally out of view, right? It's not a subject of political debate. And so how do we think through that, right? What does that mean about us as citizens, about us as a republic? And what does it bode for the future of warfare and for even our ability to actually achieve the kind of effects that we want in the world, right? Those are the kinds of concerns that I had and that I've been really writing about ever since I got out of the military in 2009.
I'm really glad that we're going to go a couple of different places with this, but I'm glad that you made the point about political debate, because this is, I think, a very common idea that I think left, right, and center, you can agree, there's very little debate that's happening in the sense of like a public, rigorous, steel manned on both sides debate. That being said, something that also, you know, is expressed in the jacket of your book is the fact that, you know, 20 years of these wars, and this isn't the sole cause of how divided the country is right now, but obviously, and you have a good essay about, you know, that post 9/11 moment, the country is far more divided than it was then. It seems to me that we're not quite capable of having debates around these wars without that division making those debates inherently toxic. So for example, we could and should have a debate about the $40 billion of arms to support Ukraine. There's a bunch of different bits there. Does that include MiG-29s? Does that include howitzers? What are the scopes there? Should there be an inspector general? But very clearly, from my perspective at least, many opponents of that package are bringing domestic political beefs into that debate. So I guess the question I'd ask for you then is, how does one have a debate in this 2022 America without just, because frankly, I guess the way I'll put it is, I'm not willing to sacrifice Ukrainian lives so that we can have a fake debate that's not going to really be substantive.
This is always the justification, right? That, you know, the political process is messy and there's demagoguery in the political process. So leave it to the experts, right? I would say that, you know, the past 20 years have not actually suggested that that's a surefire way to success, to put it mildly, right? I also think that the kind of military policy that you get, and look, I'm not a pacifist. I'm not an opponent of the use of American military force around the world at all, right? This is not a kind of sort of strident critique of any kind of military action or presence around the world. What it is a deep concern about accountability at the end of the day, right? And yeah, is the political process messy? Is it ugly? Is there demagoguery? Sure. Is that preferable to a situation where we're not paying attention to this? We're not actually having public debates. And one thing that I should note is that one of the reasons that we don't have political debates is because of political decisions that were made, right? So, you know, we don't have an authorization for the use of military force for, you know, some of the more recent conflicts because we've been relying on an open-ended authorization for the use of military force that was signed in 2001, right? And that has been used and sort of was famously extended by the Obama administration to include ISIS, which didn't exist then. It's been used to attack groups in Africa that have a somewhat, have a fairly tenuous relationship to Al-Qaeda that don't necessarily seem to pose any direct threat to America or any immediate threat to America. The Obama administration also sort of argued that we should be able to do strikes using sort of doctrine of prolonged imminence. So if you have an imminent threat, you can strike somebody. And they said, well, you know, there's a period of prolonged imminence, right? Which is essentially sort of, you know, the targeted killing version of preventative war, right? Sort of Bush era justification for the use of violence. And I think that those things should be debated politically, right? Because when we do them, I think that the use of lethal force is the most morally serious thing that we do as a country. And we are a democracy. And so that should be debated. And if Congress is unable to handle that debate seriously because our elected leaders are irresponsible, then we have a lot of other problems, right? But I don't think that shielding ourselves from the difficulty of making hard political decisions will make us a more responsible nation, right? And also, like, you can have absurd commanders in chief, right, with no real congressional check. So all of the sort of expanded authorities that were argued for during the Obama administration went to the Trump administration, right? And depending on your politics, you might think that's a great thing or a very, very dangerous thing. And so I think that there's no real moral argument for an extended period where we're constantly saying, but this is an emergency, so we can't have any kind of real democratic accountability or process. And this is an emergency, so we can't have any real democratic accountability or process because lives are always going to be on the line, right? And yet that is precisely why it is something that we need to think about and debate.
You know, I'm glad you framed it that way because you helped me separate out different actors, different stakeholders who are debating, right? So you obviously have members, they're members of Congress, representatives, people in the Senate, those are the ones who support the authorization of military force that's, you know, very, very open-ended. At the same time, then you have the public, you have citizens.
Yes.
And I'd like for you to talk then about how citizens, and even just like what the word really means to you, because I was trying to write a question around citizenship. And it's one of those words where it's semi fourth grade civics cringe, but it also at the same time means something, but yeah. I couldn't really come up with a way of articulating it. So like, what is the citizen side of this look like to you?
Yeah. Just the average citizen. You know, I think that, I think, you know, one of the kind of recurrent themes in war literature, and I'm a fiction writer, is, you know, returning to the homeland, not recognizing it, feeling a certain amount of resentment. I mean, this goes back to, you know, Odysseus returning to Ithaca, and he doesn't recognize the shoreline, and the only person who recognizes him is his dog, right? And there's a kind of resentment that can build, right? Because you've been off in a place where the stakes are life and death, and you come back to what often feel like, you know, detached political debates, or sort of what the veteran John Renahan referred to as the prim moral style of the ideologue, right? When you're sort of trying to work through, you know, a complicated mix of emotions about like, okay, what was that I was a part of? What does it say about me, about the military, about the war that I fought in? What does it say about my country, right? And then you're also trying to reconnect with the civilian society that you've been disconnected from, right? And that can easily, I think, curdle into a kind of resentment. And it can curdle into, and it can sort of create a sort of difference, a separation between a sort of warrior caste on the one side and civilians. And you'll see, you know, really kind of ugly versions of this, people putting civilians down, or suggesting that they have no real role, right, in thinking about war, right? You wouldn't know, you weren't there. So, and when I was in Iraq, there was this saying, and I talk about this in the book, you know, we were at war while America was at the mall. And it was this way of saying, like, we're doing something really important, and America's off doing frivolous things, right? Of course, you know, not that many years later, I was at the mall trying to figure out the difference between, you know, 3 to 6M and 6M onesies for my baby. And I was like, oh, like, I'm at the mall and America's still at war. What do I think of this? And actually, you know, this is probably where I should be because my baby needs clothes and doing the basic things of being a father and family member are important. And in theory, the thing that you sign up to defend in the first place. And so where should that role be? And then on the sort of flip side, I remember being at an event in, I think this was 2014, 2015, I forget the exact year. But this was after ISIS had retaken Fallujah and Ramadi, you know, and this Marine stood up in the Q&A after a documentary about the war. And he said, you know, I'm a Marine Corps veteran of Iraq. That used to be something I was incredibly proud of. If you'd asked me a couple of years ago to make a resume of my life, not a resume for a job, but a, you know, counting of who I was, what I was, all the biggest bullet points would have been, you know, Marine sergeant, combat veteran, led Marines in combat, right? But now I'm looking at Iraq and I'm looking at what happened there. And I'm wondering, was I part of an evil thing? Because if I was, I don't know who I am anymore. I don't know what my identity is. And for me, there's a kind of linkage between those two anecdotes, right? On the one side, I don't think that the moral burden of failed policy, military policy, ought rest on the 18 or 19 year old kid who joins the military, right? Who's already shouldering the physical and psychological burdens of war. That job of ensuring that he has a mission that is worthy of what he's offering is a collective responsibility, right? Likewise, I don't think that, you know, if you're a citizen and you're not focused on military affairs, I don't think that that is something that makes you contemptible, right? I think there's many different ways of being a citizen, many different causes in which people attach themselves to. But I do think that there ought be a sort of sense of shared burden, shared collective purpose, shared responsibilities to the state that we're all part of. And as long as you're doing that, I think that that's really crucial. And so I think that, you know, the citizenship for me, you know, it's about the sort of rights and privileges that you have as being an American, but it's also very much about, you know, the duties that come along with that.
You know, the thing I was thinking about as you were explaining those anecdotes is, and I know that this is on the mind of audience members, you're going to get asked a lot about this. Like, where and how does the draft play into this? Because it's an interesting topic because on the one hand, you could say, well, a draft after September 11th could have ameliorated at least half of what you know, really talked about there. On the other hand, the draft threatened to tear the country apart during the Vietnam War. If you talk to any military professional, they will tell you that the all-volunteer force is empirically and clearly a superior military than the military that we ended Vietnam with. Sure. So there are these very strong arguments against the draft, but now that I've basically, you know, revealed my perspective on it, I'm just curious how you think about it.
I actually don't think that a draft would change a tremendous amount.
Really? Wait, so, quick, can I be specific then? A draft after 9/11.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that might have been a little different, right? But in terms of the way that we wage war now, I mean, to be honest, it's we're not doing the kind of large ground presences that we had during the time that I was there, right? We've changed the strategy to do things that are a lot lighter, a lot less sort of short-term costly, and that use, you know, tends to be special operations, special forces, guys who, you know, as one special forces sergeant told a buddy of mine, he's like, our job is to be America's French Foreign Legion, to be nobody's, you know, son or daughter when they die. And that's not quite the case, right? As we saw in Niger. But
can you explain what you're referencing
in Niger? Yeah. There was a couple of troops were killed in Niger, and that was when much of the country learned that we had troops in Niger, right? Including one senator who I know sat in on briefings about Niger, but, you know, presumably is just one of many places where we're deployed. And it's not always clear where we have troops who are actually in danger, right? And that's another thing in terms of political decisions. We're not embedding reporters with special operations troops, even though that's the main bulk of the mission that we're on now. The Association of Military Reporters and Editors regularly, you know, requests embeds so we as American citizens can have some better idea of what's happening with our military. And those requests have been denied. And so, and then there are countries where, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine who's a researcher, he's a former EOD officer, and now is a researcher at Amnesty International. And, you know, some of the countries where we're deployed, he said, they're a total black box, right? And we only know, you know, if we had people in combat when they end up getting killed. So, it's a small portion of the overall force that is being heavily relied on, right? That has been expanded since 9/11. And yet I have a certain degree of sympathy for the idea. I do think that a national service as a requirement, or at the very least as a kind of expectation of Americans, would be a very good thing. I think we need more places where people are thrown together with the whole range of Americans that you meet in the military. I mean, like when I joined the military, that is when I fully stepped outside of the bubble that I've grown up in my entire life and, you know, met people from very different corners of America, right? And learned to work with them, right? Which is very valuable. And I think that certainly there are plenty of people who they don't want to be in the military, and the military very, you know, definitely there are some first sergeants who don't want them in the military either, but who could do something useful otherwise. I think that sense of you know, being tied to a collective purpose and a collective mission and being tied together with other Americans pursuing, you know, goals that you find worthy is something tremendously valuable. I don't know that it would change a lot in terms of our military policy, because our military policy is currently designed to be inscrutable.
You know, it's interesting. I like the use of the phrase, would it change anything about our policy? It seems to me the assumption. So here's the question. So here's, I think, the I'll now advocate for the draft now. One could argue, right, that, well, if I knew that I, Marshall Kozlov, could get drafted, I'm like 30, so like I'm likely outside of whatever the range would be. But, you know, if when I was 18 through 25 and I knew I could get drafted, that almost certainly would cause me to pay more attention to foreign policy decision-making issues. I think then to argue back against myself, though, as I say that, and I'm curious how you think about this, I'm not sure any policies we've undertaken during the, let's say, 20-year like Iraq-Afghanistan space would have been any different had there been a heightened amount of attention. So, for example, like you're talking about drone strikes, Anwar al-Awlaki, right? You know, like, you know, the drone striking of an American citizen. I don't get the sense that that decision would have been any different had there been more debate engagement. That's one of those like topic areas that seems to be up for debate that you're referencing. But I'm just curious, like, how much do you think our status quo military policy is due to people being unengaged versus our political leaders have a decent, and this is probably what I think, have a decent like knowledge of what people actually are good to go with. Syria doesn't happen for a reason in 2013. Obviously, we engage in Syria, but we did not do the full Obama red line in 2013. Like, how do you think about this?
Oh, I think things definitely would have been different. I mean, imagine a world in which the president, if he was going to be killing people abroad, had to, on a regular basis, go before Congress, explain what the mission is, what it was going to cost, why we were doing it, what the benchmarks of success were going to be, and then had every member of Congress vote on it. And then if we're still engaged in that mission 2 years later, had to come back and explain himself and be judged against the benchmarks of success that they'd set 2 years before. I assure you that would change policy in small and large ways, right? I think that being forced to, and also I think it would do something very important as well, which is it would articulate the mission for American troops, right? You know, there are troops at one point, you know, a Marine told a,
is this the Afghanistan story?
Yeah.
This is. I was smiling because this is a good. Yeah, this is. I think this is the perfect example to explain what you're talking about.
He just. You know, he told them this war is stupid. So what? My country's in it, right? There's no. You know, no real sense of belief in the mission. It didn't seem to be something that was being publicly defended and advocated for, right? And so it was sort of like, okay, I'm an American, I'm proud, I'm a proud Marine, therefore, this is what I do. I put myself in harm's way, I try and protect the Marines around me, and that's enough. But, you know, you don't get to that point if you have more rigorous accountability, right? You know,
quick interruption, because I cheated and wasn't referencing the right story. Could you tell the story of, I think they were Marines during the surge, going around and being asked by like Afghan villagers what they were doing there? That's the example I was thinking of in terms of like that is just a literal example,
sure,
of what you're talking about.
Yeah. So this is the first time I've heard variants of this story, but the first time
it's one of those stories.
It's one of those stories that you get. And it goes like this. The first time I heard it was like in 2009 or 10, where like, you know, Marine units like deep in the mountains of Afghanistan, they go to this town, and this is like years and years after 9/11, and the villagers come out and they at first like speak Russian to them because they think they're Russian. They're like, no, we're not Russian, we're American. They're like, you're American? What are you doing here? And they're like, oh, well, there were some bad people in Afghanistan. They flew planes into buildings and the buildings fell down. You're like, but how did they land the planes in the building? You know, like just trying to explain the whole situation. And then like at a certain point, it's like, they don't get why we're here. We're not really sure why we're here or how we can connect that particular story that we're telling to this mission that we're doing right now. But here we are together, right? And so, yeah, that kind of... that kind of thing. You know, I think that the forcing political leaders to actually articulate what you're doing and why, and then having people argue for it and vote on it matters a lot. And it matters a lot to the troops on the ground to know what the purpose of what they're doing is, right? Other than just being America's warrior caste who does this.
You know, this is interesting because I'm curious. So like you said, you were in Iraq during the surge. So the height of violence, you know, the civil war is happening, all these different bits. You were literally a public affairs officer. So this was your job. How would you have articulated in 2007, right? So once again, no WMDs. Mm-hmm. There's obviously no connection to 9/11. So many, if you just asked a soldier or a Marine or airman, sailor in 2003, most of those rationales that they probably would have echoed, mm-hmm, and this would be an informed person, would not be valid at that point.
Sure.
So in 2007, what would you articulate?
But you have to understand, I joined the military in 2005. So, you know, all those things I already knew, right? It wasn't news to anybody in 2007 that there were no WMDs in Iraq, right? It wasn't news to anybody in 2007 that like the war wasn't going to be a 6 week or 6 month war like Donald Rumsfeld promised us. It wasn't news that we kind of screwed up and that there was a giant insurgency, right? We knew all that. And so the mission was fairly clear, which was we were trying to bring down the level of violence so that Iraq could have a functioning government and society, right? Which to me at the time seemed like a great mission, right? And violence did go down while I was there. So I ended my time in Iraq feeling great about the experience. I mean, that's the sort of strange thing, is it's so much of how you ended up feeling about the war just depended on where you were and what was going on at that time, right? So I knew these guys, they were there through 16 months, right? So a long deployment. Good group of soldiers, National Guardsmen. They'd been there through 2006, which was horribly violent in Anbar province. And then they got extended from 12 months to 16. They lost two guys. And they felt so black about that deployment. And I remember there was like a video teleconference with their families back home. And like, you know, the senator was going to be there and the mayor or whatever. And they were talking beforehand, like, well, what do we tell our families? Do we tell them the truth about how we feel? And they're like, no, there's no way we can tell them the truth, right? We'll tell them the truth when we get home. And then like, are we going to tell them the truth when we get home? How long will it take us to tell them the truth about how we feel about this deployment? And then the unit that came and replaced them came right in the middle of 2007. So right as the violence was about to just kind of drop off a cliff, and they left feeling like they'd won the war, right? And you know, that's how I felt for a while. And then obviously, you know, you have the rise of ISIS afterwards in 2019. I was traveling through northern Iraq and, you know, talking with people who survived genocide and talking, you know, going to people's homes in Mosul that have been destroyed by airstrikes and them talking about the last days of the fight against ISIS in that city. And, you know, my God. That's an experience that makes you think very deeply about the war that you've been a part of, right?
That also brings to mind another question. And this is why it's important that you were there in 2007. So you are there, you know, 2009, drawdown begins, 2011, you know, the status of forces agreement expires. So we officially just leave the country. What do we owe to the people of these countries that we occupy? And this is incredibly relevant in Iraq, because in 2011, you know, once again, it's complicated. The Iraqis wanted us out. So this isn't quite similar to the situation in Kabul in that sense, but we leave in 2011. And then 3 years later, you've got ISIS, and obviously we re-engage. And then in Kabul, Afghanistan, we just leave. And then you obviously, so much of the tragedy was people trying to get out, right, as if this were, you know, Saigon in South Vietnam. So what do we owe them?
Well, I mean, it's clear there's a lot of things that we owe that we're not going to be able to provide, right? You know, you mentioned Afghanistan. One of the things that should have been easy, but, you know, or should have been a straightforward response from the administration that wasn't, was...
And is this Biden administration?
Trump administration, Biden administration, Obama administration, the failures of this program stretch back, but bringing people who risked their lives for us over to America, right? I've been talking with folks who've been stuck in Kabul. I've been talking with folks who have been active in the community of civilians, and also there's a decent number of veterans involved who've been trying to work cases to get people over to America, sometimes people in desperate circumstances. I was talking to one soldier who's trying to work a case in the last days, you know, as the Taliban took Kabul, where there was a woman who'd been beaten by the Taliban. She was on a death list. She had fluid in her lungs. She's in the hospital. Under a fake name, the doctors are hiding her. And she's trying to like assemble the paperwork for her extended large family to see if they can get out of America. And she just has no real hope of getting through this bureaucratic system. And she asks this soldier, you know, why are our lives not worth saving? And, you know, he doesn't really know how to answer her, because to him, and he's just, you know, he got out of the military, he's in his civilian life now, but his interpreter saved his life multiple times, he feels, when he was in Afghanistan. So, and his interpreter still has family members in Afghanistan who are at risk. So he feels like this is a duty that my government has failed. So now it's on me to try and help people get over. And he's just meeting roadblock after roadblock. And there are just so many stories like that. I was talking to a father. This was, you know, not long after, this is in, I think September. And, you know, we're on video chat. He's in Kabul. And he's already had to flee his home because of death threats, not just against him, but against his daughters. And he takes his phone, he goes in, he's like, it's 9 o'clock, you know, like it's not time for sleep, but all my kids are asleep because I don't have anything else to do. And he shows me this large bed where all of his children, he's got these four beautiful kids, three of them girls, who are, you know, very worried about what their future looks like in Taliban controlled Iraq. And he's, you know, he says to me, he says, you know, as a father, you have so many hopes and dreams for your children's future. And now there are no dreams. This is our real life, and there's nothing here, right? And there's so many people like that. And we knew for months. I mean, I met activists in this space months and months before August, who were talking about all the things that the Biden administration had to do because of the coming humanitarian crisis. And all that stuff, there was no real interest from the administration. So we were met with chaos. And of course, during the Trump administration, it was almost impossible for interpreters or people who had worked with the Americans to get their families through. I mean, just those cases just totally dried up. So that's a very clear case where it's like people who actually stuck their necks out for us, risked their lives for us, whose families are now at risk, and we just left them twisting in the wind, right? Which is morally grotesque, okay? It's also strategically stupid, because I was talking about that style of warfare that we've switched to. Well, so much of it relies on, you know, special operations forces working with local partners, right? And, you know, America, if we're a country that has a reputation of not protecting those folks, of leaving them out to dry, betraying them, that has real impacts, right? In terms of just America's ability to function, right, as a military, right? So there's a kind of real politic reason that it's stupid, as well as a sort of more idealistic reason. That's why, by the way, like every US general who's ever set foot in either theater has argued at some point that we need to do a better job with this stuff of protecting our soft networks, as they call them, right? So that's like a sort of bare minimum requirement of what we owe these countries that we're not fulfilling, right? And then, you know, in terms of sort of broader case, right? I mean, dealing with countries that have been shattered, and you know, sort of basic obligation under international laws, you need to provide stability if you invade a country, and we're not really capable of doing that. So I think how we interact with the humanitarian, you know, the current government of Afghanistan, where there's a giant humanitarian catastrophe, is a complicated question. And then there's a sort of very fraught political situation in Iraq, right? And so I'll give you one example of something that concerned me. So as I mentioned, I was in Iraq in late 2019, and it was a very kind of dynamic time because there were huge protests, youth protests in Iraq against corruption in the government, against the current government. There was a huge amount of anger towards Iran because the Iranian-backed militias had fired into crowds and killed a lot of protesters. And so there were sort of, you know, Iraqi politics are a complicated thing, but there were sort of spaces for movement and change, right? And one would hope that there were folks who were doing things to push that in a more positive direction. Not very long after that, we killed Qasem Soleimani in Iraq, along with the leader of one of the Shia militias. Now,
who was he?
Is an Iranian general whose specialty was proxy war, right? And was, you know, behind the deaths of a lot of American soldiers, and was a pretty noxious figure around the world. And I don't shed any particular tears for him. But one thing that was really frustrating to me about that whole thing was, you know, I think that because we're very good at killing people, right? We've developed an incredibly sophisticated mechanism for a system for targeting people and killing them, right? It's like nothing that's ever been seen before. You know, Joint Special Operations Command went from doing 6 raids a month in 2004 to 300 a month in 2006, right? And that is, you know, we change things about how we organize operations and intelligence and bring different agencies together and a whole other host of things that change. We're very, very good at it. But the real question for me in all of these conflicts is, okay, what happens after the violence, right? Because the second and third order consequences of killing people are often really, really important ones, as we have learned repeatedly every single year of these conflicts. And yet whenever we have something like that, it seems like we only want to talk about, you know, Qasem Soleimani and what this means for, you know, America and Iran. And there was no interest in what that was doing in the domestic, you know, Iraqi political scene, how that was going to change things in Iraq, what sorts of challenges and complications it might throw into the works at a, you know, as I mentioned, like really dynamic and volatile time. And I think that is just sort of fundamentally irresponsible, right? And this is also the thing, to go back to the earlier point, right? We have troops in Iraq, they're doing a mission. What is that mission? What is success supposed to be like? You know, does doing one thing maybe hurt the mission of the other thing? And that should be, you know, sort of talked about and debated, not just sort of inside the Pentagon, but in public by our elected leaders. I think that's probably something that we do owe those countries.
Yeah, no, two responses. So one, I like how you zoomed in on the example of the interpreters, because there's a wide gap between we commit ourselves to stay in Afghanistan forever,
yep,
and what happened. And the interpreter example is right in the middle.
I supported the withdrawal. This is the thing, right? You know, I think there was a lot of, especially as the Taliban was taking Afghanistan, there was a lot of unrealistic thinking, right? Especially among the sort of more hawkish sorts. And they're saying, all this could have been avoided if we just kept, you know, 2,500 troops in Iraq. And it's like, are you kidding me? Sorry, in Afghanistan. It's like, are you kidding me? Like, Afghanistan was not a stable, like, you weren't maintaining equilibrium with 2,500 troops, right? So,
And if that's true, by the way, what were the surges about? If that was the number.
So how many troops would you really need to add to Afghanistan to sort of maintain a government that, you know, I think you could have basically poured infinite resources into it and it never would have been sort of self-sustaining. And the reason that I think that is because we basically did that and it didn't work. So, you know, and then you have these like ridiculous arguments from the sort of more neoconservative crowd where they're like, well, we've had troops in Germany for decades. And it's like, yeah, you know, it's not like the troops in Germany were, you know, holding out against Bavarian insurgents slowly encircling the, you know, the major cities and shutting down beer halls and forcing everywhere to wear lederhosen. Like it was a sustainable deployment because there wasn't a freaking war going on. And that's, you know.
And I think to your point, obviously, also, if Afghanistan were the equivalent of, let's say, Germany in 1956, the debate would be much different than the way the debate actually turned out. And I just want to grab another thing you said here, because it also, I think, sums up the initial back and forth we had on.
And by the way, one of the things that was frustrating was during that time, if you criticized, you know, our handling of the evacuation, people would assume that you were arguing for forever occupation of Afghanistan. It's like, no, not at all. I mean, like Matty Iglesias, right, was sort of throwing out ridiculous bad faith arguments left and right on this score because, you know, he wanted withdrawal from Afghanistan. So he was opposed to anybody being concerned about the human cost of it at all, which I just find kind of morally repulsive. Right. And so, you know, I think you've got a lot of folks who wanted somehow to have a kind of clean answer mm-hmm. to that war, whether it was, oh, we could have just kept, 2,500 troops and we would have had no casualties forever and everything would have been fine on the one hand. And then on the other hand, like, there's nothing we could have done. This was always going to happen. Getting out is good. Therefore, let's not worry about the fact that there are thousands and thousands of people in incredibly desperate circumstances who, if we cared enough, we could help, but we're just not helping because at the end of the day, we don't care enough.
Yeah. And I think it also gets to the point we were having about why there needs to be like a public debate or affirmation of what we're doing. Because one of the, I think the most tragic parts about the withdrawal is, and saying we let people down feels like so minimalistic relative to what happened. But if you are a young woman in Afghanistan, the burqa has just been full burqa has just been reimposed. There are educational limitations. You know, if you read what we were saying in 2011, this was not what was on the table. And what actually has been revealed is that there wasn't, we said a bunch of things during the war in Afghanistan, what our objective were, how we were going to handle it, the length of time we were going to commit to, that actually were not seriously adjudicated or backed. And the second that the question was actually put to the test in 2016 and in 2020, because, you know, President Trump and President Biden were probably the two most likely to pull out of Afghanistan. The reason why Trump didn't is a whole other story, but there's a reason why he made the deal with the Taliban that he made. So if there had been a more consistent and open articulation and debate of what our actual war aims were, we likely would not have made commitments that we would not actually enforce. We did have a very active in the 1950s in Germany. We had an active debate about how we would protect Berlin. This was a very active and articulated policy that stood the test of the Cold War. We did not have we had a disengaged debate. Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. Like, we're going to, provide schooling and it's going to be great. Like, but that wasn't actually real. So for this last section, in our last few minutes, I honestly want you to, you don't need to rake me over the coals, but like rake me over the coals because, I work at a think tank where, people at the, I work at Hudson Institute, there are people there that play like a very direct role in orchestrating the war in Iraq. And audience members really don't like that. And they also get frustrated when I am hawkish on Ukraine because I did not and probably will not serve in the military. Yeah. My weird line of pushback is that, look, I opposed the no-fly zone. I opposed NATO boots on the ground. And Adam Kinzinger served in the military. He went to Iraq. So it's not quite clear to him. He was in the Air National Guard, but he did a deployment. It's not clear to me at all that civilian versus military experience, especially the type of military veterans who tend to get elected to Congress, results in anything different. I think Adam Kinzinger was one of the most reckless people during the entire debate over going to war in Ukraine, and he'd served in the military. So there's a lot of feelings there. So like, there's not really a question here, but this is just what I'm thinking about a lot.
You get this a lot, right? If somebody adopts a hawkish stance, they get called a sort of chicken hawk or an armchair general.
You just saw my email inbox. So,
and I don't like that line of attack because I think if you are committed to the idea that we are a democracy and that we decide these things collectively, that means that decisions about military policy, every citizen has to have equal voice on that, right? And you can bring your experience into the debate, but I think, you know, trying to stand on your military experience as a way to shut people up is obnoxious. And, you know, oftentimes, you know, your military experience doesn't necessarily mean that you have a great grasp on grand policy. I remember seeing, Rob O'Neill, who's the Navy SEAL who claims he shot Bin Laden, on Fox News. And they're like, so what do you think about negotiations with North Korea? And he's like, well, as a Navy SEAL, it's like, you were a commando. Like, I mean, it's a very hard job that requires a lot of skills, but international diplomacy is one of them. I mean, in terms of skill with diplomacy, Navy SEALs don't rank very highly in terms of the considerations of other people in the military, right? It's like, they're really good at, you know, doing a high altitude, high open jump into a bay where a pirate ship is parked and climbing up the anchor chain with a knife in their teeth and taking out pirates. Like, that's what they're really good at. But they might not necessarily have the best opinion on Afghanistan, or not necessarily a bit better opinion than, you know, like a random member of a neighborhood PTA, right? Or neighborhood schools PTA. And so I think that if you're serious about the idea that this is a democracy, we all decide these things together, war is the most morally important, morally fraught thing we do as a country, and everybody needs to be engaged, that means that some people are going to take a hawkish position, some people are going to take a dovish position, and you're going to have to meet them on the merits of the argument, not on, you know, not on whether or not they've actually served.
I want to be fair to my good faith critics.
At the same time, and, yeah, I get yeah. I do get it, because yeah. I think that
there's something, there's something to it.
You want it to be real to people, right? You want people who are advocating for these policies to have actually thought through the human consequences of them. Now, again, I'll say, folks who served don't always do that, right? I've seen incredibly reckless policies advocated by military veterans.
Donald Rumsfeld.
and very, very thoughtful, you know, ones advocated by civilians, right? So it doesn't track. It just, what grates is when somebody sort of blithely ignores the human cost.
I think I think the way I'll sum up the feeling then is, because I think this is, and this is why your book just like spoke to me, because like, once again, I think the there that exists in the good faith version. And look, people are polite when they do this pushback. So I'm not trying to dunk on anyone necessarily, but I think, and this is the reason why your book appealed to me, is just that I think there is something missing from my relationship to the military and to the specific wars we fought also, but I was in fourth grade at 9/11. So like, it's complicated there too, but I think people are just I think one of the debates we need to be having, and I think a debate that your book can help advance, is what our military means, given how we really unironically do live in unprecedented times. Like, we are actively deciding what the borders and boundaries of Western Europe are right now. Mm-hmm. We are engaging in different types of warfare right now. And there's all these questions about China, Taiwan, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that's where I'll leave it, just because we're not going to resolve anything in an hour, but I think that it's the open space that folks should be engaged in.
Absolutely.
Well, Phil, this has been really helpful. The book is Uncertain Ground, Citizenship in an Age of Endless Invisible War. Actually, what I will say on the last bit here is, we didn't have enough time for this, but TikTok and the war in Ukraine, this war feels, and Twitter, the war in Ukraine feels very visible right now. I think that's going to be,
that is probably a particular way. I have a lot of thoughts on that, but yeah.
So yeah, that's for another day. Yeah, for another day. But just as I'm saying the title out loud, I'm like, But yeah, once again, thanks to you for joining us on The Realignment.
Yeah, thank you.
Reminder, Substack, subscription, bookshop, book purchases, and of course, huge thank you to Lincoln Network for supporting our work. We'll see you next time.